He is one of the country's leading intellectuals, the apostle of conservatism. Now, for the first time, William F. Buckley speaks at length about his faith. Raymond Arroyo joins Bill Buckley at his home in Connecticut for an exclusive interview to discuss how Catholicism has shaped his life and ideas. Straight ahead on The World Over. From our EWTN studios, Raymond Arroyo.
Welcome to The World Over. At 71 years of age, you could say William F. Buckley is returning to where it all began. With his usual gusto, he is again tackling religion and faith. Though primarily known as the champion of conservative ideals, his first book, God, Man, and Yale, dealt with religion and education. Now, 40 years later, he's written a personal reflection and defense of his faith, Nearer My God. A few weeks ago, we joined Mr. Buckley at his home in Stamford, Connecticut, to discuss the book and the Catholic beliefs that have shaped his life and work.
If we could go back to the race.
Oh, it's a perfect day.
We joined Mr. Buckley on one of those idyllic early fall days. He shed his usual coat and tie for a more relaxed aspect. Contrary to what some might expect, I found Mr. Buckley to be warm, welcoming, and great fun. I was even treated to a tour. Being a writer, his office behind the house was one of our first stops.
Excuse the mess, but I can't pretend it's the only day we've got a mess.
Is this where you write your articles when you're here? And
yeah.
Your books?
So I do all my work here.
Primarily your articles.
Yeah, I'm either here or in Switzerland. I very seldom work in New York. This was a four-car garage.
Oh.
So the first few years I did one and another one. Inevitably, that happened.
When you write, I'm told you play Bach.
A bit, yeah.
Why?
Well, why not? I don't play well, but I got a piano here and an organ over there.
But when he really wants to get to work, he just presses a button. The tranquility didn't last long.
Hello?
Buckley?
Yeah.
Hi. Are you familiar with the Joe Smith?
To avoid any interruptions, we retired to the patio for our interview.
Why did you write this book?
Well, the book was not my idea. It was a publisher's idea. And I undertook it and then abandoned it after a year. But then I got itchy about that. I felt bad. And so a couple of years later, I simply took it up again and felt it's an obligation, I think, to a believing Christian to use whatever skills he has to proclaim his faith. I'm not a missionary, but I like to hope that I can enunciate some of the wonderful things that Christianity has done for me.
I came across a quote from you where you said, "I'm a dogged evangelist when it comes to my economics and my politics." Why not your Catholicism? Why haven't we heard previously this vocal an enunciation of your belief?
When I said I'm a dogged evangelist, I would mean in my public life. I don't ever discuss politics at home or casually. But it isn't as though Christian dogma or Christian doctrine were going to be voted on by the Judiciary Committee on Friday. To the extent that public laws impinge on Christianity, I'm extremely vocal. And in all of my books, I think almost without exception, there are perfectly frank admissions of my own faith. My very first book was half of it devoted to the neglect of religion at Yale. So there isn't any sense in which I'm hiding, but I simply acknowledge that the culture of our society is not one that encourages casual conversation about the Apostles' Creed. It just plain doesn't.
In his book, Mr. Buckley poses some tough theological questions to the forum.
a panel of converts to Catholicism, among them Father George Rutler and Father Richard John Newhouse. But I wanted Bill Buckley's opinion.
I'd like to get you on the record on some of these issues. I'll put your question to you. Would you be disappointed, outraged, or defiant if the church were to authorize non-celibate orders?
I would be respectful of it, by which I mean there isn't anything in me which is absolutely outraged by the idea. So I would simply accept it as the working of a magisterium. I would be disappointed if it were thought to have happened as a result of public pressure, because I think the church's reputation depends very heavily on its intellectual and spiritual independence. So that I agree with all members of the forum. Most of the members of the forum profess themselves to be very disappointed if that were to happen. Not so, for instance, Russell Kirk. And I would be more in his corner than that of the others.
Would you be disappointed, outraged, or defiant if the church were to withdraw its prohibition on non-abortifacient birth control?
I'd be quite dismayed on the grounds that it would require me to reorganize my whole philosophical understanding of the human being. I would consider that absolutely I consider it inconceivable. I'm trying to be cautious for this reason. The Catholic correctly reposes faith in the infallibility of the Pope in transgressing on either reason or a correct understanding of Revelation. Now, this is one of the reasons why the Pope often sounds so attenuated in what he says. He doesn't want to sound too conclusive, but on this particular subject, it seems to me that the evidence is so plain that it's on the order of euthanasia. So I would be when I use the word defiant, I sort of winced, because it's not a word that I would it's not an alternative that I would consider myself as capable of. And the reason for that is faith in the church as the custodian of God's word. Under the circumstances, if I am correct in that postulate, I could never defy anything the church said. If the church said something inconceivable, that genocide was occasionally blessed, I would have to say, well, I got to rethink the whole thing.
I want to change gears for a moment and talk a bit about your father. Yes. They say the father's faith often affects the children, and that's whose example is often mirrored and mimicked. What was your father's faith like?
Well, he was a lifelong Catholic and a deeply committed Catholic. He wasn't ever ostentatious in his practice of his religion. And not that my mother was, except she would make more frequent references to the church and to God. But with Father, it was simply a given. And I think I mentioned in the book that if you happened into his bedroom just before he was leaving it to go wherever, you'd find him on his knees, praying, which he did before getting up and before going to sleep. So he was a very fervent Christian without being evangelistic. He sent some of us to Catholic schools, but it was simply never thought problematical that we would continue as Catholics. Being a Catholic was a given in our family.
Mm. You said, I am not trained in the devotional mode, nor am I disposed to it. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean by that that some people find it easier than I do to express publicly inner thoughts and emotions.
I think there's no doubt that Bill does not like to wear his conscience on his sleeve. John O'Sullivan is editor of National Review and Mr. Buckley's chosen successor. His first education was in an English Catholic school, and then subsequently in an upper-class American background. You don't feel comfortable with talking about what's in the inmost recesses of your soul.
I think that kind of, what should we say, tension is part of his Catholic sensibility.
You have a hard time opening up on these issues, or it's difficult for you to express these matters, perhaps, is what I'm trying to say. Is that true at all?
I think it's probably true, yeah. I think it's probably true. Malcolm Muggeridge had initially the same kind of difficulty. Both he and I can and do and have expressed outrage or indignation, whatever. But to express, as Malcolm Muggeridge once put it, one's love for God is something one thinks of as an intimate declaration. My point simply is that I'm simply not good at it. And lacking the kind of a sense of security that A. Fulton Sheen had as a result of his magnificent conquest of that particular skill, then I'm vain enough to feel it's a good idea not to do that which you can't do very well. I finally gave up playing the harpsichord for that reason.
Maybe he hasn't totally given it up. There is a boyish enthusiasm in all he does, whether plucking the keys, riding the seas, or playing with the puppies. His joy is evident.
Why a devotion to that breed?
I think they're so pretty.
They are. They're beautiful.
They're so pretty. I don't understand people get ugly dogs since you don't have to.
For all the pleasures and accomplishments of his life, it is National Review that Bill Buckley will be most remembered for. And though he doesn't spend much time in the editorial offices, they still reflect his spirit, his whimsy, his biting sarcasm, and yes, his Catholicism. Two Catholic magazines, The Catholic Eye and The Human Life Review, have shared editorial offices with National Review since their founding.
His Christianity definitely shows through in the magazine, but it's more than that. It's Bill is lives his Christianity, lives his Catholicism.
I want to talk for a moment about the intersection between your politics and your faith. Russell Kirk said your politics are more a function of your faith than your economics. How true is that?
The Bible absolutely insists on individual sovereignty and conscience and makes the case for freedom. God created us to be free. Under the circumstances, if you want complementary positive law, it should be a law that encourages that freedom. In my judgment, that which does so most successfully and which permits the development and the distribution of scarce resources is conservative political ideals of the kind that I have backed. That is the sense in which the two are connected. The insistence on the individuality of the human being. If we are, in fact, in God's eyes, all different, then any society that seems to say that we are not different has got to be wrong.
Looking back on your life and your career, was there ever a time or an occasion where you wish you'd spoken out more on an issue concerning your faith, or an issue where your faith came to bear?
I don't think so. My late brother-in-law Brent Bozell thought I was a little late getting in on the importance of abortion. He's probably right. Some of us understood Vatican II to be more indulgent than in fact it was intended to be about different views on that subject. The idea that we should respect other people's differences in Protestantism or Judaism or whatever was mistaken by some, including me, to think that we should be indulgent of people who thought that on abortion, well, that's the way this particular denomination thinks about it. I was a couple of years late in coming around on that particular point. Most of the other points in which I've been adamant on the subject have been rather reactionary than progressive. I deeply and publicly lamented the changes in the liturgy and the abandonment of the Latin, and I talk about it in this book.
You say something very interesting. You say recruiting the congregation into hyperactive participation simply hasn't worked. Why?
Well, I think that the natural disposition of the Catholics I know, certainly the Catholics I grew up with, is to nurture a relationship between them and God through the priest. It is not in the tradition of let us 100 people sing hymns vociferously. I'm all for it, by the way, and I did at school, at a Protestant school, but it's not, I think, in the Catholic cultural tradition. The priest is the mediator between God and the congregation viewed individually, but to take the congregation and think and attempt to make it a collective body that reacts collectively, recites prayers collectively, works less well, I'm sure, than was hoped, which is one reason why the Latin was successful.
Now, many people will say the Latin is foreign. We can't understand it. The priest has his back to us.
Well, the answer is it was never understood. But I also make the point in this book that the English is never understood. Most of St. Paul is inscrutable. And, that which is why volume after volume after volume of exegesis is perpetually going on. But prayer is so infinite in its subtlety that the notion that one can parse it into John, Jane, Jip English is simply incorrect. And on top of that, some of the terrible translations that have been visited on us since Vatican II make one wince aesthetically. One wants to put things in the ears or things in the eyes. So I find, on the whole, you're much better off reading your old missal, I find.
And is it because of the intimacy? Is it because of the mystery there in the silence?
Look, there has got to be a difference between the kind of English used by the Douay or St. James and the kind of English that you'd expect at the corner drugstore. And there should be a difference. There's an ennobling, inherent quality in fine prose that suggests biblical dimensions. To eschew that on the grounds that there must be no ambiguity as to meaning and that everybody should sound as though you were ordering a Coca-Cola for refreshment, I think it's incorrect. Blessed be the poor is simply different from happy be the poor. And if one's ear is insufficiently attuned to that difference, one should choose another profession.
I want to return in our final moments to the book. How do you pray? You said in an Esquire article, not an article, it was the in the Proust questionnaire in the back of Esquire several years ago, you said, when asked, what is the thing you'd most like to improve or learn better? You said to pray.
I've read a couple of books about how to pray, and they tend to say what you expect them to say, you know, dislodge your concern from all other things, but I'm not particularly good at that, and therefore I don't get the kind of nourishment that I know is there and should be there from entirely successful prayer. This doesn't mean that I don't get nourishment from it. I do. But I always hunger for more, and I pray that I will be given that extra ration.
Do you have a favorite saint?
No. I think it's correctly stated by one of the members of the forum here that our underappreciation of the saints and of saintliness is our great, great delinquency. The saints are marvelous, marvelous, marvelous people. I say this, you know, St. Teresa recently gone, and the capacity of that one woman to sway a multitude of people reminds one of the dimensions of saintliness. I have no doubt that she will be canonized.
At 16, you wrote this to your mother. Probably the greatest contribution you have given me is your faith. I can now rely on God in almost any manner. Who was she? What was her devotion like?
Well, my mother was very devout, a Catholic, and she went through her life with this wonderful sense of intimacy with God. There wasn't anything she thought too petty or too inconsequential to sort of consult him about. Now, she didn't do this in any sense that suggested effrontery or co-optation. It was just the natural way she was. Occasionally, when serious questions arose, she would literally wonder, what is the right thing to do or think about this particular issue? And in struggling for an acceptable conclusion, she would often be guided by her understanding of the Christian thing to do. That's why I find it so sad that so many people aren't even aware of the Christian alternative as a source of illumination and of comfort.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's, of course, heavily the result of secularization and narcissism. The Randian, Ayn Rand concern with oneself, eliminating any idea of altruism, the mysticism of the mind, and so on and so forth. The concentration on one's own pleasures is pretty complete. And, of course, the sad thing about it, as Malcolm Muggeridge discovered, is that one's pleasures are only very finitely satisfying. The kind of satisfaction that one gets from spiritual work is lasting.
I'd like you, before we go, to read this final passage here, just from there, in your book. This is where, in the epilogue, it is dedicated to your mother.
This is the last paragraph of the book. 5 days before she died, 1 week having gone by without her having said anything, though she clutched the hands of her children and grandchildren as they came to say goodbye, the nurse brought her from the bathroom to the armchair, and in flexible rules, she put on her lipstick and the touch of rouge and the pearls. Suddenly, and for the first time since the terminal descent had begun a fortnight earlier, she reached out for her mirror. With effort, she raised it in front of her face and then said, a teasing smile on her face as she turned it to the nurse, isn't it amazing that anyone so old can be so beautiful? The answer was yes, it was amazing that anyone could be so beautiful. God's creature, well done, Lord, my Lord, our Lord.
After reading this book, what would you like readers to come away with?
A desire to buy it.
Assuming they've already bought it, what do you hope they come away with after they finish?
Well, I hope I would have succeeded in reminding some in whose memory it might have slipped of the enormous strengths of Christianity and of Catholic Christianity, and perhaps enticing some people who have not been enticed to explore the resources of the Church, also to take pleasure from the expression of faith, and to stimulate a even more love of the religion I uphold.
Nearer My God is now available in bookstores from Doubleday. This is Mr. Buckley's 38th book. Until next week, you can reach us with your questions and comments on the internet at EWTN News@EWTN.com, or write us here at the network. Keep sending those ideas. Remember, you can find us here each Friday night. In the meantime, we'll be scouting the world over to bring you all that is seen and unseen. For all the staff and crew of EWTN News, I'm Raymond Arroyo. See you next time.